Yeah, that's when I discovered at an early age that when you surprise people with shit, they're more likely to give you what you want. And it was purely through I created like brochures for my parents. And a career was born.
Listeners, and welcome to season 2, episode 13 of Bad Voltage. And I think that means we're closing in on 100 episodes.
We are.
Yeah. I can't remember how many we are. It's not this one, is it?
No, I think this has got to be mid 90s.
Yeah, we've got another 5 or so to go yet.
Still anyway, time to pod fade.
No pod fading here. My name's Jeremy. With me, I have Jono and Stuart. And what are we going to talk about?
Well, we're going to get into some news as we do on every show, and we're actually going to have quite a meaty discussion about Yola and a big round of funding that they brought in and their new business model and all the rest of it. And we're also going to talk a bit about Fedora and Ubuntu, so stay tuned for the news.
And then our friends at System76 recently made an announcement about a spin on Ubuntu, or is it an OS? Is it a Pop OS? Find out in the segment.
And in a previous show, we ended up having a brief discussion about old computers and how we got into this. And we said, we'll come back to that. And now we're going to come back to it.
And crap all over the Archimedes, which is an important point.
And finally recognize the unbelievable genius that was the Archimedes, is what I believe you meant to say there.
Lesson from this is, have low standards when it comes to old computers. You can be Stuart too.
And now, Bad Voltage.
No.
Time for some news.
It is. And I think, Jeremy, you should go first. Speak the news.
Oh, all yes. Right. So I kind of have a two-part news story this time. And the first part of it is that someone, and it's not clear to me exactly who, but someone that was kind of involved with Yala, but not with Yala, is reviving the Yala tablet design, including Sailfish, and it's already raised $80,000 on Indiegogo, which surprises me a little bit given how the whole Yala tablet thing went down. But related to that, and even more surprising, I think, is that Yala has now raised over $70 million, with a business plan to quote-unquote develop Sailfish OS as the rival of Android and license it to mobile device manufacturers for income.
What are you guys' thoughts on that? They want to
raise $100 million because that's the number they think they need, but they have already reached $70 million is mildly surprising to me.
Is it Yala that supports Android apps?
Yes.
Well, so they want Sailfish to be a competitor to Android.
It'll be its own developer platform.
Yeah, but it does run Android apps, at least some of them.
Yes.
Right. Ones without Google Play dependencies, right?
Well, the thing I think is interesting here is, I mean, the $80,000 on the Yola tablet design is, as far as I can tell, basically trading on exactly the same, monetizing exactly the same thing that Yola thing did in the first place. People going, I really want this to be the case, and therefore I'll put money towards it. Which is, you know, a good thing. Speaking as a guy who owned a Nokia N9, right?
The only guy who owned a Nokia N9.
That's not true. Right?
I had the 900.
The other two liked it as well, right?
I had one. It was good.
It was beautiful device. But that's exactly the thing. I mean, I love the fact that this is kind of aspirational. I think people are aspiring in the wrong direction, but who the hell am I to tell them otherwise, right? Whatever. But that feels like it's very kind of community-focused project, 80,000. I don't think it's going to go anywhere, but whatever, no problem. But the idea that Yola have raised $70 million...
Yeah.
...in order to be a rival to Android. And it's not like they can go, we've got this great idea, we're going to be a rival to Android, because why hasn't someone with $70 million said to them, but that was your great idea 5 years ago and you utterly failed. Why would we pay for this again?
I'm not entirely sure.
I would like to know, A, where that money came from, B, what the business model is, and C, what the opinion of the sources of that money is about this. Because
I read to you their business plan verbatim. That's from them. The quote that I gave is their quote, when they've laid off a bunch of people and got out of hardware, that was their pivot quote.
Yeah, I mean, really? to be clear, they have actually changed their approach since the last time they did this. Before, they were doing a whole kind of vaguely Apple-y, we do hardware and software, the same thing. They've got out of the hardware business because it died rambunctiously on its ass. And now they're pushing Selfish, the platform. It's not very clear to me whether their goal is to work like Android, and so they'll have loads and loads and loads of hardware partners, and they'll get in bed with all the big people like Samsung and HTC and what have you, or whether it's at the moment they're working with small names. The licensing partners are Intex, who are Indian, and Inoi, who are Russian.
Yeah.
And this feels like a very kind of canonically, we've picked these people because they're prepared to go with the same as sort of BQ or Meizu or whatever, which again is fine if they're delivering the hardware and so on. I don't see what's different this time.
Well, it says the Sony Open Device Program is going to be the first actual phone, they said.
The thing is, as well as, I mean, if this is the definition of history repeating itself, right? Because this is where people often talk about how they have an angel on one shoulder and they have a devil on the other shoulder. With me, I find I have on one shoulder like the kind of 18-year-old, just got involved in Linux, kind of like idealist of, we can build anything and we can like change the world, right?
That's
which
what
is very much a common thing. And then on the other shoulder,
the idealism like, thing, the aspirational thing is great.
Right. But then on the other shoulder, I find like the 38-year-old dad who's got a mortgage. These two things are at odds with each other because on one hand, I applaud this, but on the other hand, the fact that they've raised, I mean, look, we all know that, I'm assuming this is venture funded.
So
we all know
to quickly answer your question there, it's $9.4 million from the Finnish Funding Agency for Innovative Technology, which is a government agency. And it doesn't give names, but it says the vast majority of Yala's funding has been received from angel investors in China, Russia, and Italy. First of all, I don't consider investors. $70 million angel funding, but that's a separate.
Yeah, unless it's the Archangel Michael, that's not angel
right,
funding.
Unless your friends and family includes, you know, Larry Elson or someone, that's not angel money.
I wonder if they must have, like, with that many angel investors, and they must have, like, 49% equity in the company.
I don't know. I mean,
51% equity in the company.
I suppose there's an outside chance they just got 1,000 football stadiums full of people who all contributed $1. I mean, it seems unlikely, but you know.
I think it is. Wow. Well, you know, I would love to get someone on the show to ask them about this. We don't do interviews very much these days, but I'd love to.
I would definitely be curious if we can get someone from Yala on. That would be great, I think.
Yeah.
Let's reach out.
Well, I'm interested in the Sony Open Device Program, right? Because as you know, I have idiosyncratic opinions on hardware, but
no.
Sony
really?
are one of the few companies out there who are actually making nice hardware devices. The Xperia range is nice, right? It's attractive in a way that most of them aren't. In general, my policy is don't buy Sony stuff because they just screw us every possible way they can and never learn. Yep. But the idea of this open device program sounds interesting. And I'd be happy to try out a Yala phone in the same way that I was happy to run the Nokia N9, right? And I love that phone to bits.
Yeah. Interesting.
If they can recapture that, what I'd love to know is I think they could actually build a model of selling, you know, no semi-high volumes to people who are prepared to do something a little bit out of the ordinary. Go for the sort of eclectic, the sort of thing that Essential are going to go for, I think. But if they're trying to build Selfish as the rival of Android,
I guess I'm assuming they're banking on is Google does something so stupid that one of the really large manufacturers is willing to take a chance on something that isn't Android. And that's a risky bet, I think.
The thing is, though, it all circles back to the same thing that we've talked about in the past, which is this is all about apps, right? Is that consumers are not going to move to a platform that doesn't have the apps and games that they care about. So building a new platform is relatively straightforward. Canonical did that with Ubuntu. It's getting the ISVs and the app vendors to move their apps over. The only way in which you can do that is to pay them. Maybe that's the source of this money. Now, if they're using 70, if they're going to use like $20 million to pay Microsoft with Skype to pay the Angry Birds people, to pay all of these different games developers to move stuff over, I think they'll actually have a shot at it.
I will make an argument that even that doesn't matter. Microsoft paid all the developers to port most of the major apps, and they have very strong existing partnerships and a brand name where they can go to carriers and actually get a meeting.
Right.
And they still and they don't have 1% of the market.
Yeah, I know. Anyway.
And, I mean, well, I bet you they dropped $1 billion so far. So
we've spent 8 minutes on news item one. So why don't I spend 30 seconds with another piece of news?
Yep.
Also, Linux related, we're seeing a pattern. So it turns out that Fedora 26 has been released. Fedora, which is for those of you who have been living in a cave or have computers that work, is a Linux distribution for the desktop.
Wow.
that was a joke,
that
people.
That was not a beefy miracle right there.
Nothing about me is either beefy or a miracle. We should just get that straight. So so apparently there's going to be GNOME 3.24 is going to be in there by default, and LibreOffice 5.3 is going to be in there. I believe that this is all now running using Flatpak and Wayland, and at least I haven't used Fedora for a while, but I've used GNOME Shell. And I think it's a really nice kind of platform. I'm a big fan of GNOME Shell, and have been for a while. So, good work, Fedora people.
No, well done.
We like you.
We do.
All right, what have you got, Jeremy?
I had the Yala stories, but I'm going to let Stuart.
Oh no, sorry, Stuart. What have you got?
mine's a quick one as well, and again Linux related. It turns out. Now the Ubuntu, Windows subsystem for Linux has, this is Bash on Windows or Ubuntu on Windows, however you want to look at it, has existed for a while, but it's now actually in the Windows Store, which, and that in itself is not particularly news, but it's an interesting time to sit back and say, people seem to like it. I was quite surprised, I assumed it was going to be kind of a bit of a boondoggle, right? Kind of, okay, so you can run Ubuntu on Windows, but no one actually cares, whatever. This is more Microsoft clawing as they descend into the pit, never to return. But actually, they do really seem to be turning themselves around. I'm consistently seeing people going, you know what? Windows doesn't seem that bad, right? The new Surface Books are nice. People are saying, I use Windows as my developer platform, but I run the Ubuntu thing. I run the Windows subsystem for Linux. So and now they can just go one click, it's there in the Windows Store. It feels like maybe the Microsoft people are coming back.
I've said this before on the show, but I continue to be impressed more and more and more with what Microsoft are doing. And this clearly is and I've heard this from Microsoft people, that since Satya came in, like he's just had such a phenomenal impact on that company. And I'm super impressed. Microsoft are actually a company now where, if someone came up to me and said, hey, I've seen this cool job at Microsoft, I'd be like, yeah, you should go and check out working there. Like, they're a genuinely interesting company, I think. They're still evolving, but
I was going to say, it's definitely certain departments are lagging and certain departments are leading in this regard, but some of the areas are really doing some pretty cool stuff.
And the impression you get is a little bit that it used to be that you kind of, okay, we're winning, so we're not going to do anything open or anything cooperative or anything decent anywhere. And then even if they were losing, they still wouldn't. That's now changed. In markets where they're second or third, they're like, no, the way to do this, the way to be better here is to cooperate and be open and so on and so forth. If they're ahead, there doesn't seem to be any desire to lead from the front with openness. It's all, we will use openness as a counter against someone who's better than us. Right? So the Surface Book, for example, you say, okay, can I stick an Ubuntu USB thing in? Oh, no, that's all locked down. Right, it's why not cooperate here? But so there is they've learned at least not to shy away from openness, qua openness, which is, I think, a good thing.
And some of that stuff, I think, is just practical market, support questions and things like that. Like it's just, if you're building a consumer product, when Microsoft has spent years and years and years dealing with people who don't know how to use computers. So they're going to probably be overly conservative in consumer products that they release out to people. But I think it's cool. The one question I do have about this is I don't really understand the point of Ubuntu on Windows, right? I understand, how people are using Ubuntu in containers and orchestration and stuff like that. I don't really understand the real day-to-day practical use case for this.
If you're a developer,
and
this is what it's for, right? It's command line only. If you're a developer, I spend probably half my day in the terminal, right? Because I'm spinning up a server here or editing a command here or running a little thing on Bash here. And an awful lot of people, if you're developing for something which is being deployed to Linux servers, you're doing a lot of sort of Linux command line based fiddling. You tend to work in that kind of environment. If you're building something in .NET and deploying it to Windows servers and so on, then you get a very much sort of, you know, punch a button, it builds. In the same way that someone who develops iOS apps inside Xcode probably doesn't open the terminal very much.
No, that makes sense.
A lot of the stuff that you do on the from the terminal in on a Mac or on Linux, what people were doing was they were basically installing things like Git and Cygwin because it brought Bash along with it.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah.
But now you've got the whole entire Ubuntu user space. So if you're not bothered about running Ubuntu graphical apps, which frankly no one other than hardcore Ubuntu users are, but you are bothered about having a really powerful way to do stuff on the command line, it's the best of both worlds.
The reason why I was confused was my thinking was, look, if you want to use Unix, if you want a Unix command line, buy Mac or go and use an Ubuntu desktop. But I think your point about if you're building Microsoft tech apps, like if you're building .NET apps, and you're deploying them to Linux platforms, then yeah, of course that makes a ton of sense. So,
and not even that. If you're building Linux tech apps, right? A lot of people don't want to go and buy a Mac because it doesn't run half the stuff they want, and because the laptops are four times as expensive, right?
Right. I think the price is a big component. Yeah.
Both of these things.
They're also four times as nice.
Well, you see, you say
four times as reliable. Four times as reliable. I have literally never experienced the level of stability I've ever experienced in my entire career than with my Mac.
Congratulations. Well done. Why didn't you buy a Ferrari for your car? If I told you it was four times as reliable as your car, would you buy it? No, because you can't afford it.
The thing is,
Ferrari is four times less reliable.
Well, yeah.
but what I'm saying, what
unfortunately,
what I'm saying
you can't
is,
buy a supercar, which is way more reliable. I mean, the Audi one maybe, but the R8.
Well, the thing is, and I'm pretty sure that a Ferrari is a lot more expensive than my car. But my point is that Macs they definitely have premium hardware. There's no doubt about it. But what I'm saying is, it's a premium product. But I think that with that premium product, you actually get a pretty good experience. Like I've been a Linux user for my entire career, and I switch between Ubuntu and my Mac, primarily Mac these days. I have never experienced that level of stability as I have on a Mac. And also the software and hardware integration is phenomenal.
I'd be interested to hear from people who are actually working in an enterprise, so not people who read their email through Gmail, right?
Right.
People who actually need to work with the intranet inside the company and the expenses system inside the company and all this software which has existed for years and which you need to interoperate with. You can't just go, nah, I'm using my own computer and you lot have to turn on... Remember all the turn on SMTP on the Exchange server so Linux machines can connect to it stuff?
Right.
Macs are just the same.
No, I'm not denying that for a second. And I'm not saying that Macs are the best option in all scenarios. No. What I'm saying is I think Macs are phenomenal products and there's a reason why they're so popular.
If you're operating in our kind of environment, yeah. But, yeah, you see, so popular, but I think they're popular in our sphere, certainly. But I don't think they're even remotely popular with people in offices generally.
put it this way. Every single company that I work with some relative exceptions, they're all using Macs.
I think tech companies are using Macs. I think
who are aware enough, who are woke enough to need a community manager in America.
I'm not even talking about just tech companies. I'm talking about marketing firms. Design agencies.
So if you go to a large bank, design agencies have used Macs.
Well,
if
your argument is, well, they're always using Macs, therefore you can't count that in the Mac using demographic.
So he said enterprises and marketing agencies are the antithesis of enterprises from a structural perspective.
And I agree with you that, look, some of the dyed-in-the-wool kind of enterprises, big Microsoft shops in particular, they're using Windows, of course. Like, you know, like a bunch of companies, like big old enterprise companies, they're arguably using using Windows. And I agree. I'm not saying that everyone's using Macs. What I'm saying is that a ton of places are using Macs. That's all I'm saying.
I think you're inside a bubble a bit, but that's fine. We can argue about this outside the news segment.
yes, we can. Shall we get on with it?
We should. It's closing in on 19 minutes now, so.
Why don't we talk more about the first news item? So recently, System 76, who are very much a friend of the show, they build Linux laptops, desktops, servers, all that kind of good stuff. Been pre-installing Ubuntu for many, many years on their machines. Recently announced something called pop_os. Pop os.
With an exclamation.
With an exclamation.
I thought it was Popo's. See, now that's why that's why the underscore is in it.
Fuck the Popos.
That's the title for the show, right there. There it is.
So it turns out that System 76 seemed to have an oversupply of underscores because it says pop exclamation point underscore OS, a powerful operating system just for creators. Underscore. There's lots of underscores. Anyway, they also have a button on the website which says "Get it popping," which is what I imagine someone's dad would put on a website.
You know that little animated GIF of Steve Buscemi doing the whole "Hi kids" thing,
right?
No, we're being mean about it just for jokes, which is so not
it's, well. It's clear none of us are a giant fan of the name. I think,
yeah, the name.
OS 76 would have had that little old school panache to it, and I think would have been the way to go. But alas, right. They did not.
I would like to state for the record, much as I absolutely adore the work that System 76 do, and everybody here should go out and buy their computers. They do wonderful stuff, and they're great citizens in the open source community. This logo, this name. Is terrible.
Yeah.
That logo, I don't know who created the logo, but whoever's responsible for that logo should, you know, read a book about making logos. It's terrible. It really is.
I've got a certain amount of...
So should we get into what it actually is and what we think about it as opposed to just...
No, let's just spend the entire time talking about the logo and then end the segment. We should talk about what it is.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it is, as you say, it's a powerful operating system just for creators. So it's specifically designed for, I'm quoting from their own material here, Popos is designed for people who use their computer to create. Whether it's complicated professional-grade software and products, sophisticated 3D models, computer science in academia, makers working on their latest invention. The POP user interface stays out of the way while offering extensive customization to perfect your workflow. Built on Ubuntu, you have access to vast repositories of open-source software and development tools. First release is October the 19th, 2017. But hit the button, you can check out Popos Alpha now. So they've got this very clear pitch of it's for creators.
Yeah.
Right.
People who use their computer to create.
So I'll be honest with you, I haven't tried it. I've just seen the talk of this online and again, couldn't applaud System 76 more for doing something like this. I had a conversation with their CEO, Carl Rochelle, who is, again, friend of the show.
He is.
And Carl's just a super cool guy. He's built a really nice business. One of the things I was talking to him about was, as Ubuntu, this was actually at scale earlier this year, was basically saying, you know, my theory is that Ubuntu are going to kind of get out of the client business more and more.
And why don't you, Carl, and System 76, I remember this conversation.
Right. Yeah. Right. Why don't you maybe think about doing your own thing? We're actually lobbying for them to kind of, you know, focus on what's it called?
Elementary.
So, they've gone down this route, which is obviously because of us.
It is. It did actually occur to me when they did this. I thought, well, good. I'm glad we had that conversation and they took it to heart. And any more advice, no problem. Reasonable rates,
right.
Etc.
That'll be $2,000. So, but it looks from the screenshot, it looks like a theme for GNOME Shell. Have you guys tried this? Have you given it a shot yet?
I've not installed it, no.
I've I haven't actually run it. I was going to. And therefore, we are kind of speaking from a position of not actually having run it.
We are.
To be honest with you, I'm... At the moment, it's new, right? I'm not particularly interested in the... I'm not particularly fascinated by exactly what it brings software-wise. It's more about the positioning and the marketing and the place they're trying to carve out for themselves in the market. What it's for and who. I find more interesting than exactly what's there. I mean, at the moment, even if it's going to evolve in something greater, it can't diverge that much from Ubuntu at this stage.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'm guessing that the initial version of this is a theme, primarily for GNOME Shell that's running on Ubuntu, and you get broadly a similar set of things. But clearly from their marketing materials and from some conversations I've had with some members of their team, they really are kind of like optimizing their machines around creators.
Yes.
And one of the things I love about, I think Ian, who works there, was responsible for the design, because Ian was telling me at OSCON how he was working on some theming.
Yeah.
And at least from what I've seen, like, whoever's responsible for it, and if this is you, Ian, you've done a really nice job. It looks like it looks beautiful. It looks distinctive. It matches like all the color schemes of what System 76 have defined, all that kind of stuff.
I think that to me is what's most interesting about it. It's that it looks distinctive.
It does. They based it on an existing theme.
Yeah.
Right.
But they've defined themselves a visual identity.
Right.
And that's good.
I think because they got quite a bit of bollocking about this when they released it. Like, the reception was not great, to be honest.
Really?
Yes.
But I think a lot of it was
agreed.
A pretty big misconception about what this is and what it isn't. I think they maybe didn't frame it well in the beginning.
Ah, well.
And have done so a little bit better since.
I'm not necessarily sure I agree with you. I certainly agree that there's lots of, that it's not at all clear who exactly it's for and what the pitch is and so on, but I don't necessarily think that that's improved. So you talk about how you initially perceived it and how you've perceived it.
I think it
changed.
Was perceived as System 76 has forked Ubuntu and created their own distribution.
Yeah.
Which is not how that's I how see this really going. It's really Ubuntu. But obviously, once you start making a certain amount of modifications to Ubuntu, you actually can't call it Ubuntu anymore. Ubuntu's Canonical is very clear on that, which makes sense. You don't want someone completely changing someone, and then when it goes wrong, blaming Ubuntu. So that's fair as a policy. So if they, as a company, clearly want to take things to the next level, they're building a manufacturing plant in Denver, they clearly want to have more control. And I think they feel a little bit butthurt about waiting for Unity 8 so long.
Yes.
And holding up on things, and now want to say, you know what, we want to have control of what we're going to do. We want to be able to make some modifications. It's very clear that they have an upstream first mentality, which I like. So the changes that they're making to the installer and many of the changes that they're making, they are upsourcing or they are upstreaming. So it's not that they want to do this just as a competitive advantage. I think they want to make the ecosystem better, but I think they want to have some control, naming issue aside. I think they want to have some control over what they ship on their hardware. Which, as opposed to now, where it's not their hardware, pretty soon it will be. And I think they want to be able to control it from top to bottom, which I think makes a lot of sense. I don't know that you can build the next giant company shipping Ubuntu laptops. In fact, I know you can't. Well, so I think Carl's aspirations are pretty large. And for him to accomplish what I think he wants to accomplish, this 100% was the only option. There's no way around it.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. And I think there's everything they're doing from a technical perspective is bang on great. As you say, not only have they said they're going to work upstream, they've already proved in the past that they do that and they will continue to do that.
Right.
That's fabulous. They're not. It's not a little private fork in order that they can conquer the universe. But yeah, they do want some sense of ownership. I also think, in addition to your list of reasons, I think a little bit of one might be slightly disassociating themselves from the Ubuntu desktop brand.
Oh, I'm certain.
A little bit, yeah.
I mean, I think they're nervous that
in one version, Ubuntu desktop is going to receive so little focus that they almost have to take on maintainership of some large pieces.
I think it might be more that people are kind of realizing that that's the case, at least a bit. And therefore, it's not so much whether it actually receives the maintenance or not, it's the perception that maybe it won't. People saying, but Ubuntu, that hasn't changed very much. Didn't they just spend all that time on Unity? Didn't they drop the desktop, which they didn't?
Right.
But then, so disassociating themselves slightly is not a bad idea. My basic, raw, base-level concern with this is, if if you define yourselves as we are Popos, right, then everyone's going to say, but my applications don't run on Popos. And they go, no, we do because we're really Ubuntu. And this is exactly the problem that the elementary people have. They're like, no, we're elementary, write elementary apps, it's all for elementary. But then every time someone says, but does my calendar run on there? Does my camera run on it? They go, no, really? We're just Ubuntu, really? And then you go, oh, but you're really just Ubuntu? What, you're just a skin? And they go, no, we're not a skin, we're a different thing. But so it feels very much like what the elementary team want to do is they want to go, no, we're completely separate and we're way better than Ubuntu and we make the following changes and that makes us better. But at the same time say, no, we're Ubuntu to take advantage of that name recognition of the last 10 years of ISVs building stuff like Steam, which works on Ubuntu. And Popos is going to have the same problem. And I do not know how you get around that.
I don't think
System 76 have got the marketing muscle to go out there and push this as a thing for creators as a whole, because they can't afford to maintain a whole OS.
I think there's two pieces in here in my mind. One piece is there is no doubt that part of the reason why System 76 has been successful is because of the tremendous brand recognition of Ubuntu, right?
Yes.
Is that, and I've heard this from System 76, like, you know, the thing that's worrying about the position, they didn't say this, but what the thing that's worrying in my mind about Canonical moving away from the desktop side of Ubuntu more and more is that it puts System 76 in a really difficult position, because that Ubuntu brand recognition is going to degrade in that sense. People will see Ubuntu as a server thing. So, to Jeremy's point,
what System 76 end up doing is they sort of get pulled down with the ship to some extent, right? If people start to think, I'm not sure Ubuntu desktop's right for me anymore, then you think, well, why would I go to System 76? What they do is Ubuntu desktops. They do System 76 desktops.
But this is to me where this is interesting, is that, so they had, to Jeremy's point, they had to make a change of some description, and it's better to do it now than to do it in 2 years' time. I'm actually kind of surprised how long System 76 have stuck with Ubuntu, because for all intents and purposes, Unity 7 hasn't been touched, with some exceptions, for the last 2 or 3 years, because all the energy has gone into Unity 8. Now, the other component here is to your point, Ak, about the apps piece. What I think is going to happen here, and what I think should happen here, is that the center of gravity around applications is going to move to GNOME. So what's going to happen is you'll go and get a System 76 machine with Popos on it, and what they will market is you get the GNOME Flatpak store or something along those lines. So the applications that you get are actually going through the GNOME platform, and that means that System 76 can ship that, Dell can ship that, whoever else can ship that. But essentially what you get is an optimized desktop and some preloaded applications around that. So it's not that... You know, in the older way of working, it was these applications support Ubuntu and Fedora and whatever else. I think what's going to happen is that the GNOME Flatpak store is going to be the center of gravity around that. That's at least how I think it should be. Then it's less specific to the individual distros, because frankly, the individual distros don't have enough might to be able to do that. And the major distros now are all shipping GNOME. The tricky thing here, in my mind, is it's not entirely clear to me whether the GNOME store is going to support non-free apps. I suspect that the GNOME team, I don't believe this has been decided on yet, want to naturally only deliver open source free software applications in the store. If that's the case, it'll be dead on arrival. People want Slack. They want, you know, other applications. They want to be able to go and buy applications.
Yes.
So to me, that's what I would be lobbying for. If I was in the shoes of System 76, in the shoes of Endless, in the shoes of Dell, other people who were invested in shipping Linux desktops, I'd be wanting to work with the GNOME project, so they're the center of gravity, and then app, you know, ISVs only have to focus on making sure that it works well with GNOME.
But then imagine that happens. Imagine what you say is the case. System 76 do this, a whole bunch of people go, okay, that's where it is. The center of gravity is there. It's with the GNOME project where we use Flatpak apps and so on. But then you say, okay, who makes sure that the sound works on these laptops? And the answer is the Ubuntu project, though. But the Ubuntu project will be like, why? I'm not really sure why we should, right?
Oh, yeah, I agree. I think that the downstream distros are going to, for all intents and purposes, go away, as in many ways. Because, I mean, as far as you know, I've heard on the grapevine that Red Hat are less and less interested in working on the desktop, which I can kind of understand why. Canonical are clearly less interested in working on the desktop. So who else is there? I mean, if Brian was here, he'd be suggesting SUSE.
Yeah.
But as far as I'm aware, SUSE are focusing on the enterprise cloud.
Well,
we
now have a bunch of kind of newer distributions, newer names are taking over from the old guard. You've got people like Elementary, Popos now, people like that, who are based on existing things, right? A lot of them based on Ubuntu, so on and so forth. But if those old guard go away, you think about people at Canonical, there were people being paid to work on Pulse Audio, people being paid to work on printing. You know, these kind of low level things. Now, the Red Hat people keep a lot of people like that who work on lower level infrastructural pieces and don't get any of the name recognition. But we've seen in a lot of large open source projects that people are happy to use them but not necessarily happy to fund them. This happens outside the Linux desktop, right? Things like OpenSSL, GNU PG have this kind of problem. And it becomes difficult to support something like this when something like Popos, if you're sort of assuming that someone else is handling the low-level stuff. I mean, I would very much like to see System 76 essentially become the new Canonical, if that's what it takes. I don't know how you get there from here.
They've indicated that that's the direction that they would like to take.
$200 million.
Right. They've indicated that's the direction they want to take. They obviously do not have nearly the engineering staff to do that today.
I wonder, can they bridge from here to there? That would be brilliant if they can.
They're going to need to take a significant round of funding. Because I'm assuming System 76 are largely privately held, but they're going to need to take a significant round.
I don't think they're going to need to. There's no reason why you can't bootstrap it.
Right.
You don't have to take $200 million off of VCs in order to be successful.
Yeah. Well, no, but where are you going to get the money? Unless you're a wealthy dude, where are you going to get the cash?
By selling things to people.
Yes.
And right. Then we see, you know, the way you're supposed to make money.
But the point is, they're already selling things to people.
Yeah.
Right? So they've already got revenue coming in. I'm guessing that the revenue coming in, if they're gonna embark on this journey, they're gonna have to mitigate the risk to a certain degree, right? So they're not gonna want to put.
I would argue that taking VC would be the opposite of mitigating the risk.
No, there is risk attached with both of these approaches. What I'm saying is, I'm guessing for them to hire the necessary level of staffing to effectively become an upstream distribution, what they're going to need to do is to hire a significant chunk of engineering, which will soak up most of their annual revenue. I'm guessing there's more risk attached with that than taking VC funding and the risk that's associated with the VC funding is my guess. And this is all hypothetical because we don't know their numbers and all the rest of it.
Right.
That's why people get funding, right? So they can pursue new business objectives. That's primarily why they do it.
Kind of.
Yeah. So,
but I think where we all agree is, if they're going to have to do this, they're going to need some more money, wherever that comes from, to hire some more people.
That I think is the. But I mean, I love the fact that they've grown to a position where they feel comfortable doing this. I mean, I'm sure Carl and his team must have sat there squeaky bum time quite a few times going, can we do this? can we spin up our own fab plant for manufacturing? Can we brand our own OS? And they've decided to go for it, which means it can't be, you know, an unbelievable bet everything on Red 32 risk, right? They must have a plan. you speak to the team and they're all smart people, and Carl's built the business for nothing in a decade, right? Well played. So, I'd love to see it be successful.
I agree. And the one thing, just from personally knowing Carl for many years, and it's not like I talked to him all the time, we talked to him very occasionally, but the one thing that struck me more and more as the years have passed is he's become just more and more kind of gritted teeth about making the company successful. Not just, yeah, we sell laptops with Linux on it. It's like he's got the bit between his teeth to make this into a really successful company.
Right.
And I would say that I think for many years, System 76 were doing cool stuff, but it was kind of unremarkable. It was like, okay, they're shipping Ubuntu on laptops, and you saw them, and the laptops were okay, but it was like, okay, cool, they're doing that, whatever. But I would argue in the last year or two, they've really upped their game. Like, their website looks phenomenal, their team looks happy.
Yep.
Like, you know, I just think they're just... they're firing on all cylinders.
They've certainly decided to take a much more, I don't want to use the word proactive because it's a word for wankers, a much more pushy, direct approach. You know, it's not we're going to sit back and do this. They're actually taking the game to you kind of vibe, which is good, I think.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So, I'm
kind of worried that it won't work, but realistically, you've got to be in it to win it, right?
Right. Yeah, I agree. I mean, and put it this way, I think they, not that this really probably matters to System 76, but I think we can safely say that they've definitely got the Bad Voltage team rooting for them. Yeah. And much as the logo is terrible for Popeyes.
And the name.
Right.
Yeah. But I think the one thing a lot of people didn't understand either is they weren't just shipping Ubuntu on laptops, right? They already had most of the engineering in place to produce a kind of custom spin of Ubuntu for their specific hardware. So this is not as big of a leap as I think people initially thought it was.
Right.
It was already in the company to do this. They're just...
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, this is more a perception thing than anything else. If, regardless of the fact that whether what they're doing is just basically a thin layer, a thin super straight layer on top of Ubuntu, or whether it's deeper, whatever, doesn't matter. It will be perceived as its own thing. So if you've got a million customers and every one of them comes to you to say, "Why doesn't my camera work?" and you have to say to them, "Oh, you're allowed to just go and look on Ask Ubuntu." Well, there's no Ask Popos.
But that's not what they do now, really. They have a support team that does that. They don't tell their paying customers to go search on a forum.
No. They don't.
I think that's what's interesting about them is they are probably the largest organization directly talking to Ubuntu users every day. Certainly way more than Canonical is, right? Like, they have paying customers every day calling a support line saying, "This doesn't work, this does work." If there's anyone uniquely positioned to fix the Linux desktop, it probably realistically is them. It's certainly not canonical.
I wonder, should they talk more about that?
I think they do. People just aren't really listening. I think this is one of those things where a lot of people had a preconceived notion, and then once that's set in place, it's very difficult to change.
The other thing as well, which I'm impressed with them, it just as they're evolving, is I think they're understanding the consumer market more and more and more. And to me, one of the big pieces here was when they released the Galago Pro. Like, the Galago Pro is actually a good-looking piece of hardware. I always like System 76 stuff from a I'm rooting from them perspective, but I always thought their laptops were kind of ugly-looking. But they work fantastic. Like, they were well-made, you know, perfectly configured, but they didn't have that sheen that you might have with...
Well, that's because they had no say in the design process, right? They were just rebadging a third-party product.
Exactly. But I think when you look at the design of the Galago Pro, and when you look at the design of Popos, and when you look at the design of the website, I think they're really understanding their market better, and it would be easy for them to become one of the many, many Linux laptop vendors that basically doesn't give a crap about that stuff.
I think Carl reached a point where he said, "I don't want to be a big fish in the smallest of ponds. Yeah. I want to go to the ocean," and this is their shot to swim in the ocean.
That's a good call. Yeah, like you say, you've got to be in it to win it, right? Yeah. You've got to make this big shot. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But yeah, it's probably better than being one of the half dozen people who sell Linux on laptops and that's it.
One quick, and this may drag us on for 15 minutes, but I have a quick question.
So much. I mean, I want them to get into services and everything, right? So
right. Exactly. Well, one of the things that I think is interesting is we're seeing, like, a center of gravity forming around certain projects, right? Like, I think that GNOME 2 became a center of gravity, right? Because it was so simple and easy to use, and everybody shipped it by default, with the exception of the KDE-based distributions. Then everything kind of went in different...
I just want you to replay that sentence in your head quickly.
Yeah, remember a few years ago when there was food and all food was either bananas or it wasn't bananas?
Well, yeah, obviously. I mean,
you just came up with the not hot dog app.
Right. Congratulations. Well, I mean, obviously, KDE-based distribution is not going to ship it, but I can imagine YouTube wankers say, "Well, Kubuntu didn't ship it," right? And the reason why I said that was basically preempting you two.
Jeremy, did you have bananas or not bananas for dinner today?
I plan on having not bananas.
So GNOME 2, you know, center of gravity, obviously with things like X.org, you know, all that kind of stuff. Then everything kind of got really fragmented, right? There's Unity, there's KDE, there's Elementary, there's all these different things. Now it seems like a center of gravity is reforming around GNOME Shell, from what I can tell. And I wonder as if Red Hat if Red Hat invests a little bit less and less in the desktop side of things, as Canonical invests less and less in the desktop side of things, I wonder whether we'll start seeing a center of gravity around a kind of baseline distribution, if you will, almost like free desktop. That's kind of, I mean, you could argue that Debian's that, but I think Debian are so bogged down in process.
I think Debian are happy. Well, I think Debian are going to end up being the infrastructure for everybody. Right? I don't necessarily think they're happy to be that, but that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, they may well be.
I don't think there's agreement on the desktop at all. If you look at the new crop of things, you've got, say, Solus, which is Budgie. You've got Elementary, which is Pantheon. You've got
No one's using
you've
those.
Got GNOME. Which is fine if that's your argument, but then your argument appears to be people seem to be using GNOME Shell, so we're going to see a center of gravity around GNOME Shell.
what I'm saying is, I feel like the center of gravity is shifting, right? And I think Ubuntu was a big piece, like Ubuntu GNOME to GNOME Shell is a big chunk of this, obviously. But you know, I think if you look at it, we're going to be having GNOME Shell with Wayland, with Flatpak are going to be like a dominant. These dominant components on the desktop side of things. If the GNOME store with Flatpak ends up becoming the place where you get applications, then arguably the thing that's just going to be different is going to be the baseline operating system. And I wonder whether we're going to have that, whether people will start focusing more on Debian or something else. It seems like, you know, this was how it worked in the earlier days. And then it's like, we all went and kind of played around for a few years. And now it's kind of consolidating back here, was all I was thinking. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
The big division on an infrastructural level has always been with basically Debian versus Red Hat, right? You're a Debian derived thing or a Red Hat derived thing, and half the world is still going to be Red Hat derived things in some way, unless Red Hat completely get out of the desktop world. There's always going to be people going, "No, I want Yum."
I don't think their current contracts would allow them to do that in anything that even remotely would be considered the near term.
What do you mean?
I think they have a few very large desktop contracts that they are not going to be keen to get rid of. Because those contracts are governments and other things, they don't need to innovate on the desktop, but they're certainly not going to be abandoning the desktop.
I don't think they ever will. I don't think Canonical ever will demand.
But they can basically just put it in support mode, right? They can essentially ship what it looks like today forever. It looked like 2 years ago forever, right? This is like shipping Ubuntu 14.04 LTS and just say we're going to support it for 15 years, which is not an unreasonable thing. I mean, Microsoft support their operating systems for 10 years, which is way longer than ours.
Right.
So, RHEL is almost as long as Microsoft at this point.
On the desktop?
RHEL is RHEL. The thing to remember with RHEL on the desktop, though, is in 6 years, they don't keep upgrading Firefox.
True.
But it's supported, and they do security patches and stuff, but I wouldn't want to run it, but...
I was going to say, I'd be interested to know, I don't have figures for how many people are running that version, that sort of frozen in time desktop.
Right.
Anyone who uses RHEL on the desktop, or Debian Stable on the desktop, is pretty similar.
Yeah, so send us an email, people who do that, or comment on the forum.
It's exciting, though. It's exciting to see this unfolding in a different way. Like, it's not like, in my mind, it's not like the desktop is dying. It's just reshaping in different ways. And I'm one of the things that I said for years was I always wish Canonical got into the hardware business, which was probably the wrong thing for Canonical. But I'm really excited to see what happens with System 76. So despite your logo...
I was going to say, if they can recreate even close to what Apple has done as an experience... But it would be revolutionary and amazing, I think.
Yeah,
for
it'd be phenomenal.
And if they can do that there and then build services, which Apple are notoriously supernaturally bad at,
and do
it well, then this could be like a really big thing.
Yeah.
So a couple of shows. We were talking about something completely different, and the subject of old computers, the computers that we used when we were growing up, came up. And I mentioned the Archimedes, and the two other presenters on the show failed to recognise its unbelievable transcendent genius.
I would have thought you were more of a BBC Micro kind of guy.
I was a BBC Micro kind of guy, but then the Archimedes was like the BBC Micro plus plus, right? So, Acorn Kid all the way. So, we said, hey, we should talk about this, and this is us talking about it. What I'm interested in is the computers that we used when we were kids. I mean, right. I was, and always have been, you know, kind of a programmy type, interested in building stuff with computers and understanding them, so on and so forth. And I grew up in England. Jono grew up in England as well, but was less the sort of programmy end of the world and more kind of doing things with his computer. And Jeremy grew up in the States, who had completely different machines.
Yeah.
Now, that's actually not entirely correct. And I think we should start off by shitting all over the Archimedes. when I was actually grown up, the only thing I was interested in with computers was programming.
Oh, really?
I
apologize. I assumed that if you started that early, then you'd be better at it.
Oh, no. And that leads to the second point was I was just never very good at it. I was always interested in it. I was just never very good at it.
I picture it was a lot of 10, print Jono, 20, go to 10, and him just staring at the screen in glorious Jono.
Oh, no. I suspect it was something very much more like Jono rocks or Jono is metal or something.
Spending
the rest of his life drawing the Iron Maiden logo out of drawer statements, right?
I will give you an example of how I used this. I was really into computers as a kid, as we all were, and I always, like the rest of us, always wanted the next new gadget, the next new computer, or the next new games console, whatever it was. So what I developed a fine art in was basically creating surprising levels of like asking for shit, right? So as an example, I wanted I can't remember what it was. I think I wanted do you remember the 3DO? Games console?
Yeah.
Right? Really? You had a wow.
I really, really wanted a 3DO. And what I did is I wrote in QBasic on my computer, basically an interactive, it was kind of like an interactive brochure about the 3DO. Like, so I said to my mum, like, come and look at this. My mum and dad came and sat down. There's a menu. Like, what it is, like, one, what it is, two, tech specs, three, available games, four, educational purposes. And I basically wrote this naughty piece of code that was like an interactive thing. And my parents are not really into computers, so they were blown away by it. Like, wow, this is really impressive that he did that. We should probably get him a 3DO. Didn't actually get me a 3DO. But that was the kind of...
Because they were like $1 billion. No one had a 3DO.
No, they were ridiculous. They were
could you even buy them in the UK?
No, I saw one once. It was like £700.
It
had to be more than that because they were $700 or $800 in the US, and that was way back then.
But yeah, this is way back then. We're talking about a time when people £700 was like a year's wages, right?
Yeah, that's when I discovered at an early age that when you surprise people with shit, they're more likely to give you what you want. And it was purely through like I created like brochures for my parents. A career was born. So there you go. Thanks, parents. But anyway, so back to the Archimedes. There is a difference between you, Langridge, and I. The reason why you were into the Archimedes is because you went to posh schools.
I went to school in Bedfordshire.
Yeah, posh school. I went to school in North Yorkshire.
The coal that you were given to play with at Christmas probably didn't have a RISC architecture, I grant you, right? We'll have less prolier than thou from you, if you please.
Hey, so if you're more posh, what did you ask for when you grew up? Like a Neo Geo? Well, I'm trying to think of something more expensive than a 3DO.
I was going to say, you wanted a 3DO off your parents, Rockefeller. I never got anything like that.
No, I never got it. No, the closest I got to that level of like, I sold all of my Mega Drive games and bought a Mega CD. I had no games, but I had this Mega CD.
Wow, you were the kid at school who had the Mega CD. Is that like being the kid at school who had like the skateboard with the good wheels? And everyone was like, ooh, can I touch it?
Wow, look at those trucks.
That was the word. Yes,
trucks.
Exactly the word. No, I mean, I was an Acorn kid. Always was. Right. I had a Spectrum Plus 3, and I had I started, first computer was ZX81, but I was basically an Acorn kid because Acorns are what you had at school, right? I had the Electron at home, we had the BBC Micro at school, and then we had the Archimedes at school, and the Archimedes, as previously mentioned, unbelievable transcendent genius, also created the ARM chips, which everyone is using.
I was going to say, ARM did come out of it, so fairly impressive, if we're being honest.
Yeah. You didn't get that from the MSX?
You did not. But, I mean, all I knew about the American market was in the back of sort of magazines and things, there'd be, you'd have tips for games and stuff like that. And it'd say, you know, this game running on the Tandy Color computer. And be kind of, what's that? Ooh, I don't know what that is. None of my mates have heard of this thing. And people would go, it's a thing that happens in America. You know, everyone would go, ooh, America. Like, it's like ice cream, right? You get like pistachio-flavored ice cream in America, not just chocolate, vanilla, or strawberry, which is all the UK did. You've got all these kind of exotic things in America.
People talk about fake news, but when I was a kid, I'm sure it's the same for you, Stuart. When I was a kid, the amount of fake news that related to American technology was ridiculous. Like, when I was at primary school, rumor was going around the playground. There was this thing called the Terra Drive, which was a which I later discovered was a Mega Drive built into a PC. And then later on,
PC,
right? And Amstrad brought out the Mega PC later on, right? But this was like a thing in Japan. And this kid came up to me and was like, "I have it on good authority," or something along those lines, that this is built from alien technology.
And the point was that you'd believe it. If someone said, this thing here, it's built from alien technology, say, where were you building it? And the answer was Oxford. You'd be like, no, obviously not, right? But if you said, yeah, it's been built in Nevada or San Francisco, ooh. And,
that's,
you know,
true.
Not rule it out of hand. So what did you grow up with, Jeremy?
So in our schools, we all had Apple IIe's around here, which I did not have. But I had a Commodore 64.
Ah, now we have
which is still, to my knowledge, the all-time best-selling computer, single model computer of all time.
Yep, I had one.
I'm prepared to believe that. I didn't because I had a Spectrum.
Oh, ghetto! Compared to the Commodore 64,
no, sir. Because my Spectrum was the Spectrum Plus 3 with the disk drive in it.
Well, it's still like, oh, would you like all of your games to be in cyan? Yeah, looks great. Why don't we pick a color palette of really awful fucking colors?
I know the colors were dreadful. I mean, I admit the Commodore 64 was essentially better technology, right? I mean, I would have been dragged through hell backwards at broken glass before admitting that when I was 10. But now looking back on it, yes,
they were pretty over-engineered for the time, really.
Yeah,
they were actually.
I was also
quite
informed.
Nice in retrospect,
I was also informed in the schoolyard that the Amiga was built from secret military technology. Although,
well,
to
the Amiga is really just an expensive Commodore 64.
To be fair, though, for the first 10 years of my life, I was convinced, because someone told me, that if you took the piss out of fat people, they'd explode.
But what?
Like, yeah, I was like, I had been informed that if you make fun of somebody for being fat, that basically they will literally combust. And that's why you shouldn't do that.
Okay, so world's most gullible child, Jonathan Edward James Bacon.
I'm starting to realise that this is the case. I had never realised that.
Right, so bear with me then, right? So you had 8-bit machines. So I was ZX81, Spectrum Plus 3, Acorn Electron.
Yep.
Right? And Jono, you were Commodore 64 guy, were you?
I had a... I never had an... Well, my brother had a Spectrum 48K. I kind of skipped the 8... I didn't have a computer that was 8-bit. Well, I had a Commodore 16. Was that 8-bit?
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
You had a Commodore 16?
Yeah, that was my first computer.
Wow, it was called the Commodore 16 because you and 15 other people bought it.
Yeah. I don't know.
My mate Alex had a Dragon 32.
What?
And I never met anyone. And you could only get like 5 games for it. It was like Horace Goes Skiing, and that was it.
Yeah, but I had a Master System, which was 8-bit.
Oh, right. Yeah, okay. I never had an 8-bit console, because consoles are always bigger in the States anyway, I think.
Yeah, well.
Right, Jeremy?
After the Nintendo came out, certainly, yeah.
Right. In England, everyone balked at the price of the games. It was like £4 for a game.
Because they were really expensive.
£4 for a game, yeah. And, you know, particularly where you could go and get games for $2.99 from the computer shop. So.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think my favorite part about the Commodore, and I'm assuming other things were exactly the same, were those external modems that, A, you dialed in and paid by the minute, at least in the States, which was tragic. But just the noise when they were connecting, like, indelibly connects me to my childhood for whatever reason.
Yeah.
I never networked a computer back then.
Neither did I.
I heard a BBS going. My parents would always complain when they picked up the phone and they would hear the squeal.
No,
how old were you when that happened to you, Jeremy?
I was young. I don't know, 10 or something.
What year?
Jeez.
Mid-80s, late 80s.
Right, yeah, no. I mean, here, back then, you had Prestel, which hardly anyone used, and that was it. There wasn't really anything like that. There were sort of the very nascent beginnings of a BBS scene, but people like us weren't into it.
No.
It was pretty popular over here.
Not at all. Not when we were that young.
The first
BBS I started using really properly was Arcade, which is still running. You can turn it into it today.
Really?
Yeah, it's an Archimedes BBS or Acorn BBS. Because Bill, Bill and I, my mate Bill lived at the top of the road. I lived at the bottom, and we could like dial one another up with the modem. I mean, the other thing to bear in mind, Jeremy, back then local calls still cost you money. There's no such thing as free calling in the UK back then at all. Every call you made cost you money.
It's true.
I didn't know local calls cost you money.
They didn't, in quotes, unbundle the local loop and make that. I remember campaigning for that when I was at university. They didn't fix that stuff till like the late 90s.
The campaign from me to telecommunications. I was a member of that.
Cut, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Campaign from me to telecommunications, my God.
I think I've told this story before, but I now know where my gullibility comes from, because I said to my parents, so it's 10 pence a minute for me to connect to the internet. So for every minute that I'm online, I'll put 10 pence into this box, right? And and the phone bill came in at the end of the month. It was like £280, and there's £6 in the box.
Yeah, I had exactly the same experience. I said to my dad, I'm going to do this, the bill came in, it was £212 or something. And yeah, I opened up the box, there was a tenner in it. The campaign for unmetered telecommunications was dissolved 10th of June 2001. But their website, respect to them, right, 16 years on, their website is still there at unmetered.org.uk. Well done to them for keeping it up.
Good for them. Actually, around that time, the first provider in the UK that I ever saw who did unmetered internet access, or like, you know, you pay a monthly fee, was a electronics retailer. It was kind of like a Dixon's. I can't remember what it was called. It began with a T, I think. Do you remember this, Stuart? It was like, we had one near us. It was kind of like a more modern, like a Dixon's or a Curry's, kind of like a, for Americans, like a Best Buy type place. And it was called, I forget what it was called, but if you know this, people on the internet, like, write this on the forum.
I'm not sure what he's talking about, yeah.
They basically
so you didn't have CompuServe or Delphi or Prodigy or...
No, none of that stuff. That was... CompuServe sort of existed. They had a UK branch, but nobody used it. I say, because it cost you money to ring them up, right?
My ex-girlfriend, Susan, her parents had CompuServe, and her dad, who's really cool, basically said, use it as much as you want. So I'd stay at her house on a Friday night. She got up to bed at like 10 o'clock, and I'd spend the entire night on CompuServe. And her dad was like, I don't care. You're learning about computers.
Yeah.
Like, you're the coolest person ever. Yeah. So part of the reason why I got into my career was because of Susan's dad.
I was spoiled too. By the time I was probably 14, I subscribed myself. Not my parents wouldn't pay for it, but I just saved up and whatever. And I had ISDN in the house. So I had like a Cisco router that I got on eBay used. House. And I actually had it set up so there's two channels and then a D channel. There's two data channels and then a switching channel. So you could connect both, and it was like super fast for the time. I want to say it was 128K, but if the phone rang, it would put down one of the lines, the phone would ring, and then when you hung up, the second line would go back. So you got half the speed and could make a call.
For God's sake, you had ISDN in your house.
So when I was like 14, I got my first actual job was working for one of the first ISPs in Buffalo. I helped him out, and they had a T1, which at the time was mad.
It was a brutal, unbelievable amount of bandwidth.
Yeah, it was.
I didn't even
understand how fast it was.
Like, only about sort of 2 or 3 years ago or something, I said, yeah, we'll get a couple of T1s or whatever. And they went, you know, a T1's basically nothing, right? And I thought,
1.54 megs, sir.
Yeah, I haven't updated the name in my head for what you plug into a company with loads of bandwidth since about 1998.
I have it on pretty good authority that T1s were built with alien technology.
No, those are the T3s. The T3s are alien.
So what I'm interested in is, I don't know how representative we are. I mean, John and I had quite different experiences, but it's a lot different in the States. And yeah. I'm assuming it's also a lot different. I mean, France had loads of kind of online dial-up teletexty things, I think. And I don't know what it's like in Germany, or South Korea's apparently really into the internet. And so, I mean, so I want to
believe they're the most connected country, at least today. So I am also curious.
Yeah.
Just let us know, people, because I think this is really interesting. It's surprising just how different we are.
Go to community.badfortish.org, because I think there is so many stories that people can share. I mean, we've just kind of gone, you know, down memory lane a little bit, but I'm sure you folks and some of the people on the forum, like, God, Neuro, for example.
I could say Neuro's going to go nuts with this topic. He's going to be like...
you know, I think, yeah, I mean, Neuro was... really early on this, particularly in the open source.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well. He very into a whole bunch of stuff way earlier than most people, which is really cool.
Yeah.
So we want to hear. So go to community.badvoltage.org and tell us how you got into computers and when and what it was like. There's going to be a bunch of people chatting up going, yeah, man, my first computer was a Commodore PET when I was 31 or whatever.
Yeah. But it's... Well, there's going to be the four Yorkshiremen from Monty Python kind of like, oh you had a Commodore PET? Ah, luxury, you know.
We had to bang two bricks together to get ones when I was a kid.
We should ask Steve Wally to log on.
No!
Because Steve is like... Steve can always outdo everybody when it comes to older computer stories, so... All right. So yeah, community.badvoltage.org, share your stories. You know, when we record Bad Voltage, you know, earlier on we were talking about old computers, and for the last probably 6 or 8 months when we record Bad Voltage, Mr. Langridge has been sat in his bedroom with the definition of an old computer. That where if anything else in the computer runs, like, you know, the screen, it completely interrupts the Google Hangout, and he would actually have to stop it uploading his files to Dropbox, otherwise the net connection got all wobbly. This is the first one we've had where he's using his normal computer. So thank you, Mr. Langridge. I appreciate your commitment to the cause and your service about
it. I was going to say, this is probably the first time in season two where during the show at some point he didn't have to say, wait a minute, update manager started. We got to stop for a second.
I should probably point out a couple of things in my defense, right? The first one is that old computer is one that I bought off of Jono. The second thing is that the reason I was doing that was because I had the microphone on the same desk as my actual computer, and there was a light background hum, which our audio engineer, Mr. Bacon, complained about and said, can you fix it? I said, I don't really want to because I don't want to pull my whole desk apart. However, I have now done that this week and bought myself one of these cool scissor arm things to put my microphone on, which I'm just super pleased with.
It's pretty cool, isn't it? Although you're missing an important part of the story out here, is the reason why he didn't want it to be at the desk was because his beautiful, beautiful machine he wanted to have on display. Like, anyone wants to come around and say, hey, can I come around to your house and see your big desktop machine, please?
If
it was pure vanity.
It was pure vanity. That's the whole point of buying a nice-looking computer, right? If your definition of... if your criteria for choosing a computer is... I don't care what it looks like, then fine, you and I are different. But I actually appreciate beauty, right? However, the third point is, if the spare computer I was using had been an Archimedes, I'd have been better off.
Well, actually, and how we got into the old computers discussion was through ribbing on him in between segments for his old ass computer uploading. I believe one of the comments was, "How's that Archimedes working out for you?" So anyway, so yes, so a little bit of behind the magic right
yeah,
there.
Yeah, exactly. Behind the scenes experience.
I want to say one thing actually that just kind of just sprung to mind. We had a conversation on the forum about a very, very long discussion about religion. Someone asked a question about, you know, do people believe in God, all that kind of stuff. And I just want to say, I'm super proud of the Bad Voltage community because I think it's the only time I've ever seen a conversation about religion on the internet where it was productive. It went around in circles like all conversations about religion do. But, you know, I just want to say I'm really proud of everybody who weighed into that, irrespective of your opinion. I thought it was nice to see that the Bad Voltage community, turns out our code of conduct is working well. So, yeah, thank you, everyone. That was cool. I have nothing else to say. That was it, really. I just wanted to offer some kudos.
Yeah. One other thing. Are any of you speaking at any conferences in the next couple of weeks? Because I quite like the thing last time when we said we're appearing in this in the next 2 weeks. That seems a cool idea.
Not in the next 2 weeks, no.
No, I'm not.
I'm not. I'm coming to England to hang out with the Ginger.
Yes, yes, you nice. Are.
This Saturday, those of you who follow both of us on social media will be seeing some...
You will doubtless...
images posted to the internet.
Doubtless find out. My daughter said, "Hey, I'd like to see Jono." And I said, "Yeah, well, no problem. You know, I mean, he'll be around on the Sunday morning, for example." Right. And then she said, "Okay, but I've got to leave at 12 o'clock. She's leaving at midday. And she said, "Well, will you be awake by then?" I said, "Of course I'll be awake." And she said, "Well, what time do you think you're going to get in?" And I said, "Oh, that's a good point. Because last time you were here, we went out and got in at 8:30 a.m.
This is true.
Now a lot of water has gone under the bridge since then. And honestly, God's honest truth, I'm not sure I can push it all the way out to 8:30 in the morning anymore. Especially since we probably can't wee in the pot plant outside the Wetherspoons
again. I was going to say,
or we'll get busted.
Water has not just gone under the bridge. Water went in. We were hanging out outside of a restaurant in Birmingham, and the only palm tree in central England was in a pot plant. Like it was in this you know, bowl thing out the front of this thing, and Senor Langridge was busting for a wee, and weed on the only palm tree in central England.
I should point out two things here. First of all, I didn't do that, in case you're listening, proprietors of said restaurant, which is now less than 200 yards from my flat. And secondly, it wasn't just me, right? So if I go to prison, I'm taking you down with me, Bacon.
That's fair. Well, you gotta go. So,
tune in next episode for the next edition of Grim Stories in Birmingham.
All right. So, that it?
We cannot conceivably end on that note. Stuart, didn't you ship a package to a winner recently?
I did. Our endless laptop, endless desktop machine, the Endless Mission 1, excellently provided to us by the Endless people. It has been shipped to its winner, and hopefully its winner will get back to us with their thoughts.
Did you saw it in half, as we discussed?
I did not saw it in half. I did think about sawing it in half, but I didn't actually saw it in half.
I still think that would be hilarious. Oh.
The problem with it is, I mean, if it had just been, you know, some random thing, yeah, but it's actually nice, right? There aren't that many people making nice devices. It would seem a shame to take one of the half dozen nice Linux devices on Earth and cut it in half.
Doesn't that make it, in fact, twice as nice?
Really? Uh-huh. Your opinion on nice things is you should saw them in half and make them twice as nice.
Maybe.
Go for it, Penn and Teller. In general, most stuff doesn't work like that. I don't want to disappoint you here.
Right.
A design guru I am not. No one has mistaken me for Johnny Ive, don't worry.
All right.
And on that bombshell...
We're done, because I'm hungry. I want some lunch.
Bye.
My needs come before everybody else. Bye, everyone.